who's the best athlete in the world? We could make arguments in favor of LeBron James, Lance Armstrong, Usain Bolt, the Jamaican sprinter known as the fastest man in the world, or Serena Williams. What about Zenyatta?
She's starting to pick them off, though. Zenyatta going to hook to the outside. Meanwhile, it's Colonel John Summerbird in the red cap. And Zenyatta's come to the outside. Zenyatta coming flying on the grandstand side.
Zenyatta is a six-year-old thoroughbred mare who was undefeated in 17 races, including last year's Breeders' Cup Classic, the first time a female thoroughbred won. She is the winningest horse of all time. And who better to tell us Zenyatta's story than our friend Laura Hillenbrand, whose epical book Seabiscuit tells the story of the greatest horse of another era. We've joined Laura at her home. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Zenyatta is 6 years old. She's owned by Jerry and Ann Moss. Jerry Moss owns A&M Records, I guess. Why didn't Zenyatta run as a three-year-old?
She ran at the end of her three-year-old season. That was the first time she had ever run. She didn't run at two, which most horses do. I believe it's because she is so large. Horses need to kind of grow into their bodies. She is an absolutely spectacularly huge horse. I mean, if you hollered her out, she would make a great hotel. And she is simply enormous, possibly the biggest great horse in history.
And what makes her a great horse?
She's got it all. I mean, for one thing, she's never been beaten. And to put that into perspective, in the whole 20th century, only two elite horses went unbeaten in their careers. One of them won 13 races. One of them won 15. She's won 17 and has never been beaten. And that's the biggest reason why she's a great racehorse. But she also went to arguably the most prestigious horse race in the world last year, the Breeders' Cup Classic, against the best males in the world. And she didn't just beat them. She blew them away.
And she wins in particularly dramatic fashion, doesn't she?
She's got that old crowd-pleasing style. She drops back very, very far at the beginning of the race. She lets everybody else exhaust themselves. Every single time I've seen her run, I've thought, she's not going to make it. She's too far back. And then she gets that gigantic butt going, and she starts just flying by horses. And she's so large that her stride is absolutely enormous. She just swallows the ground. And if you watch her by herself, you're thinking she's not going that quickly. And then you notice the little blurs going past her, and that's other horses that she's passing and putting away. So she likes to cut it close. She likes to toy with her opposition and wait till the last second to get her nose in front. But she's amazing. She never loses.
Who's your daddy?
Her father is Street Cry, who was a horse who won the Dubai World Cup. He's a very, very hot sire, so she's really got the good bloodlines going for her.
I've read interviews with her jockey, Mike Smith, who seems to be genuinely in awe of her.
I think she must be an incredible thrill to ride. You can actually go out on YouTube and have the experience of riding her. They put a camera on the helmet of her exercise rider, and so you can actually get that feel of being up on her back, and it's extraordinary.
And tell me a little something about her training regimen.
It's a fairly ordinary training regimen. She works out every few days and just like every other horse, but there is something that she does after her workouts. She drinks Guinness with her trainer, and you can actually go out on YouTube and watch this. She has a little plastic bowl, and she'll drink a pint of Guinness after her workout. She seems to love it. She slurps it right up. Maybe that's the secret to winning 17 races in a row.
Yeah, but she doesn't have as far as you can tell, she doesn't have a problem yet.
A problem with alcohol?
No. Yeah, yeah.
I think she's all right. I think she's all right.
She also seems to have real personality.
She does something that has come to be known as the Zenyatta dance. I've seen tens of thousands of racehorses. I've never seen a horse do something like this. When she is being led to the paddock, she begins to walk in this strange and balletic way, where she will begin hopping from one foreleg to the other and thrusting the one that's in the air out straight ahead of her like she's pointing to something. It's a beautiful little motion she makes, and everyone stares and wonders what she's doing, and I think she's just playing. I think she's just so excited about being out there and getting to do her job and getting to rub the other horses' noses in their inferiority, and she's loving it. She will do it during the warm-up. She does it right until she goes into the starting gate.
Are there commercial pressures to have her start, producing offspring?
I think there are some in that she's going to be a very, very valuable broodmare. She's very well-bred herself. And, of course, she has the racing record that nobody can compare to. But she only costs $60,000, and she's won more than $6 million. So there are plenty of reasons to stay on the racetrack. And she's her owners are such wonderful sports people. They give her to the public, and they let everyone enjoy her. Horse racing in the last few years has really taken a few blows to the gut. We had the death of Barbaro, the death of Eight Bells. We've needed some good news, and Zenyatta has given that to racing. And the most amazing thing happened when she ran her last race, the Vanity Handicap, in June. She crossed the wire, and the crowd was going insane, screaming at Hollywood Park. Then she galloped out, she stopped, and she turned around, and as she's coming back, the crowd was still on its feet. They were still cheering as if she was still running. That is something you rarely see, not just in racing, but in sport. She is a real treasure, and people feel such gratitude. There's a rapture gathering around this horse, and you know, even if you don't like horse racing, you should get out and see this horse, because we may not see the likes of her ever again.
Laura, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Laura Hillenbrand, the author of Seabiscuit, talking about Zenyatta. And you have a new book coming out. Yes, you can tell us the title, can't you?
It is Unbroken. It will be out in November.
All right. Talk to you then.
Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Jennifer Massia joins us now from New York. What did your father do?
He was a carpet cleaner.
Anything else?
Yes. He was an ex-convict. He was an associate of an early incarnation of the Gambino family. He had his own little drug-dealing crew, and in Brooklyn, he was revered for it.
Jennifer Massia is a news assistant at the New York Times. She grew up in Southern California, South Florida, and Staten Island. One year, she'd have to talk to her father through the thick plexiglass of a prison visiting room. Another, she and her parents would go holiday shopping at the swankiest stores in a shopping mall. As she learned later, they were on the lam. She's written an extraordinary book about growing up with parents who both love and lie to you, and finally learning their grim secrets. The book is Never Tell Our Business to Strangers. She joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What, you were five when you saw your father arrested?
He had just taken me home from school, and when we got home, there were people waiting for him. And they wanted to take him away right then, two men, but they couldn't because they would leave me unattended. So my mother was working as a secretary for a commodities trader. Her boss drove her home. And when I saw her there, I asked her boss, who I knew very well, he was a friend of the family, I said, "Jesse, are they arresting my daddy?" And he said, "No, honey, it's not real. They're making a movie."
You moved around a lot.
Yes.
When did you begin to eventually learn about what was going on during those years?
Well, when my father was arrested, we were living under two names. Our last name was Cassis, which was the last name of a friend of my father's. And my father was known as John in the house, but Frank outside the house. And I thought all daddies had two names, like Bill and William or Richard and Dick. I thought John and Frank were derivatives of the same name. When we moved back to New York, when I was 17 years old and surrounded by the people who knew my parents the best, I leveled with my mother and said, "Please, tell me what he did, because I know there's something you're not telling me. Everyone around me knows, and I feel like a fool." So she told me that my father had been in jail for 12 years before I was born, for racketeering, the standard litany of RICO violations. But I came to find out that wasn't the case. My father was diagnosed with cancer in 1999. About a year later, I read in the New York Post that a lot of records were migrating online. Some of those records were from the New York State Department of Corrections. And finally, I was able to look up my father's crime. And it was not RICO violations or, you know, robbing houses, stealing cars. When I looked up his rap sheet, there was only one charge on it, and it was murder.
Yeah. Who did he kill?
He killed an informant named Joe Vitale, a.k.a. Joe Fish. When he was 26, he had been running around the neighborhood committing petty crimes for about 10 years. He'd been in jail a couple times for stealing a car, and he moved on to drug dealing. And Joe Fish was addicted to heroin and informing on them to the cops. So he took him into Owl's Head Park in Brooklyn and shot him 5 times and stomped on his skull.
There were some other killings, too, weren't there?
You know, when I confronted my mother with the criminal record when my father had lung cancer, she told me that, she told me the true story about how my parents met. She'd always told me they met through friends. It turns out that my mother was a teacher in East New York going around visiting prisons with a Quaker group. Mm-hmm. And she met my father behind the glass. It was during the prison reform movement. So Attica was in the news. And my father, it turns out, had cleaned up his act behind bars and became something of a prison reformer.
Reform prisoner.
Yes. Well, he worked with the warden. He helped people craft legal briefs.
Yeah.
He taught himself. I mean, I actually went and found some of his appeals were handwritten. You know, he sounded like a lawyer.
Yeah.
I mean, he really taught himself. He had to fight for himself. He tried to get out for so many years before he was paroled. And, you know, my mother told me that when he got out of jail, they got married and he was going to turn his life around, but he didn't. She thought he did, but to tell you the truth, she wasn't 100% disappointed when he went back to drug dealing. The lifestyle, I mean, she was burned out as a teacher to her, you know, defense, but the lifestyle, I mean, they went through so much money. And during the course of that drug dealing, people crossed him. People didn't give him money he was owed, and he killed them.
Why did your mother stay with your father?
Because he was Johnny. That's what she would say. He was your father. Like, that explained everything. He was charismatic. He could be very loving. And he told her everything. And for women who like to fix men who unburden their souls, it's like a match made in heaven. He really did open up to her to an unprecedented level and made her believe that he couldn't live without her. And I don't think he could. So she profoundly loved him. She was also 43.
Mm-hmm.
She just had her first and only child.
That
and she wanted a family more than anything. She wanted a family because her first family, with her alcoholic father and chronically depressed mother, it was a household in turmoil. She wanted another chance.
Mm-hmm. I do, having read and been deeply affected by your book, want to point out that you, the three of you, this trio, by whatever names you were a very close family.
We had dinner together every night. If my father wasn't there, it was strange. We told each other everything. We were our only counsel, our only confidants. The three of us were a unit. We seemed like fugitives even after we weren't.
Well, in a sense, you still were, though, because you were sitting on a lot. You were...
Oh, yeah.
I'm struck by when he got sick, the cancer that took his life rather quickly.
Yeah.
I believe you told your father, and when you read it in the book, you have no doubt that you absolutely meant it. You said to your father, I wish it could be me instead of you.
It's funny. Because my father's not here, I can't question him about this. I never actually spoke with him about his crime of murder. My mother convinced me not to because he was sick.
Yeah.
I mean, he was 11 months away from dying when I found his criminal record, so actually I could have, but I didn't because as he was facing his death, I did not want to scare him. I didn't want to make him think of what could possibly be waiting for him as death was so close. I would not be the one to do that to him.
Yeah.
So, I never spoke about it with him, and because of that, it's like there are two John Massias. The one I knew, the one who sang songs to me and snuck me candy under my pillow, he's preserved in amber. And this new John Massia, this John Massia of FBI files and criminal records and court transcripts, is totally different, and never the twain shall meet. It's a very strange phenomenon to have, like, two fathers.
I don't want your life and your parents to sound even vaguely glamorous.
Yes, I agree.
And you know, because I despair of any young person thinking, You can kill half a dozen people in cold blood, but as long as you love your wife and daughter, it's okay.
Yes, I don't want anyone thinking this is a sexy mob story. This is a story about a man who couldn't shake the criminal's fear, who put crime above his family on a number of occasions. He lost his first family because he went to jail. He had two children, and his wife, his very young wife, was pregnant with a third when he went to jail for 12 years, when he went to Sing Sing. And he lost quite a bit because of his flaws. And I don't want anyone thinking that this is a way to live. No one should put anything above their family.
Jennifer, may I call you Jennifer?
You may.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. And I really appreciate that you really got the book, that you were moved by it. Thank you.
Jennifer Massia, her new book, Never Tell Our Business to Strangers.
If you have a shortwave radio, try scanning the dial some night and listen for something like this.
39715. 39715.
This is a recording of an actual transmission from a so-called number station. You can find these transmissions all over the shortwave spectrum. And usually it's a voice reading out an endless string of numbers, sometimes in English, sometimes Spanish, German, Czech, even Morse code. And it's long been thought that these stations play an important role in international espionage. In fact, the Russian spies recently arrested may have been getting their orders from Moscow through those transmissions. Mark Stout is a former CIA man. He's now the official historian for the International Spy Museum here in Washington, and he joins me in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So, Mark, explain how these number stations work.
Well, as you could probably hear from the clip we just played, they're not actual human beings typically these days. They're automated. They're voice simulators. Beyond that, it's all a little mysterious. These stations are unlicensed, so it's often not really clear where the physical transmitters are. And shortwaves bounce back and forth quite a number of times between the ionosphere and the Earth, which is what makes them easy to receive the signal at a long distance, but it also makes them hard to geolocate. So
that was my question. I mean, shortwave, we think of it as such an antiquated technology. So why bother with shortwave?
Well, there's actually a lot to be said from an espionage point of view for shortwave radio. First off, because it can be broadcast over such an enormous area, you can be transmitting to an agent who may be thousands of miles away. And secondly, most of the modern communications techniques involving computers and that sort of thing leave behind traces. It's really hard to erase data off of your hard drive or out of a memory stick. But all you need here, however, is a shortwave radio and pencil and paper. And paper is easy to destroy, and the shortwave radio in and of itself is not incriminating. Millions and millions of people around the world have them.
Atención. Siete, 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 ocho, tres.
Now, we know there was a case of some spies here in the U.S. caught in the past few years spying for Cuba. They were apparently listening to a transmission in Spanish. Presumably, spies are told when to listen to these stations?
That's absolutely right. They're given a schedule on which to tune into a particular frequency, and the broadcast will usually include some sort of header, basically meaning the message is now starting, and then they'll read off the numbers. They'll write them down. One of two things happens then. Either they decrypt these messages literally using pencil and paper, which is far more secure. Interestingly enough, however, the Cubans have used a different technique of decrypting these using computer diskettes, which meant that the data went onto the computers of these individuals, which turned out to be a security problem for them later when the FBI started entering their homes and searching their computers. From a cryptographic point of view, it doesn't make any difference. But from a security point of view, you don't want to put this stuff on your computer.
How long has this been going on?
Well, that's an interesting question. No one's really quite sure, at least since the early Cold War. There are some suggestions that this may have been tried during World War II, but those stories I've been unable to pin down, and frankly, I'm skeptical. The underlying cryptologic technique of what's called a one-time pad is actually a technology that was invented in 1917 by a U.S. Army officer who actually in his post-war life went on to invent Muzak. But the number stations themselves appear to be a Cold War invention.
Anybody can go to, as I mentioned earlier, to their shortwave radio, if they have one, and hear these. So what's to stop me from, or you, from listening and then intercepting these messages?
Nothing's going to stop you from intercepting them. you know, thousands of enthusiasts around the world do that on a daily basis. But just getting the transmission doesn't mean that you can read it. And in fact, this one-time pad technology is literally the world's only unbreakable cipher system. You really, truly, cryptanalytically have no traction getting into a one-time pad system, none at all.
So if someone listening has a shortwave radio and they want to see if they can find one of these stations, where should they look?
Well, you can just scan the dial and you're likely to find it. A better way, frankly, is to go to the internet. And there are a number of websites of people who monitor these stations. And you can go there and literally look up stations we expect are on the air right now. And they'll give you frequencies to tune into. So it's actually really quite easy.
That's Mark Stout. He's a former CIA officer. He's now the official historian at the International Spy Museum. Mark Stout, thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
After almost 30 years, the U.S. space shuttle program is drawing to a close, though a Senate panel approved a plan this week that would extend it for another year. There'll be one, maybe two or more last missions before the shuttles go off to museums and the U.S. manned space program prepares for what may be next. Commander Mark Kelly will captain the Endeavour's space shuttle STS-134, now scheduled to launch next February. Next Saturday, we'll take a ride with him in the Space Shuttle Simulator. The sim's a replica Endeavour that shakes, rattles, rolls, and roars as in actual flight, while sophisticated graphics flash by in the windows, Cape Canaveral, clouds of smoke, flashes of light, and finally stars. If you've never lifted off in a rocket before, the sim seems utterly real.
Hey, look at the clock. 7, 6 seconds. Yeah. The main engines are going to start. You'll see these tapes come up right here.
Yeah.
2, 1, liftoff. Watch the tower go by. And we're going straight up. Now I want you to say Houston Endeavor roll program.
Houston Endeavor roll program.
And then the Capcom would say, Roger, roll Endeavor.
The idea is to make astronauts know what to expect, what they'll see, hear, even feel in spaceflight. But they train in the sim day after day so that ground controllers can throw problems at them. The controllers push buttons to make fuel cells fail, oxygen leak, and computers go blank. Then sit back to see how the astronauts scramble to bring themselves back home. Next Saturday, a ride with the crew of Endeavour, STS-134, which is currently scheduled to lift off next February, as the crew train for the flight that will write their names into history and muse about the future of American spaceflight. You're listening to NPR News. The autobiography of Mark Twain will be published this fall at long last. He directed that it not appear until 100 years after his death. And several unfinished essays are being released with it, containing some of Mark Twain's choice ruminations, rants, and ripostes about a range of topics, including one that's sort of our bread and butter here, the interview. Mark Twain gave a lot of interviews to promote his books and speeches. According to a transcript made public this week, around 1890, Mark Twain wrote,
"No one likes to be interviewed, and yet no one likes to say no, for interviewers are courteous and gentle-mannered, even when they come to destroy."
That's the voice of our colleague Tom Cole reading the just-released words of Mark Twain. We've reached Calvin Trillin, the writer, essayist, humorist, and occasional interviewer. He joins us from station CKBW in Bridgewater, Nova Scotia. Calvin, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Did Mark Twain have that about right?
Well, I think so, although he goes on to say that the interviewer doesn't mean any harm and compares the interviewer, I think, to a cyclone that really comes to the village. I think the quote is, "For the gracious purpose of cooling off a sweltering village, and is not aware afterward that he has done that village anything but a favor."
Well, yes, exactly. Let's go on to what else Mark Twain says here.
"The interview was not a happy invention. It is perhaps the poorest of all ways of getting at what is in a man. In the first place, the interviewer is the reverse of an inspiration, because you are afraid of him. you know by experience that there is no choice between these disasters. No matter which he puts in, you will see at a glance that it would have been better if he had put in the other. Not that the other would have been better than this, but merely that it wouldn't have been this.
All right, Calvin, you've done some interviewing. Is it an incomplete, if not quite the poorest, way of getting what's in a man?
No, I think that's cross-examination at a trial would be the poorest way.
Is it the second poorest way?
It may be the second poorest way. No, I think for the I've been interviewed more than I've interviewed. I'm not a very good interviewer. Usually, I've done them with people who are such good talkers that you could just ask one question and then walk off the stage, and you probably wouldn't notice, and neither would the audience. I've interviewed, for instance, Frank McCourt once on stage, and Studs Terkel, who was a fantastic talker, and I think the fact that he was known mainly as a listener is just an indication of his monumental restraint. And I think Twain probably had another problem with interviews, and that is he was talking mainly about press interviews because he didn't have radio and television, of course. And the problem with somebody who tries to be funny in as he talks to an interviewer is that what the interviewer takes from that may not be funny because of the interviewer's ear. So I think anybody, it's true with reviews too, I think anybody who attempts to be humorous fears a really bad review less than a review that says, this fellow is really funny, and then gives as an example a line you wrote, leaving out either the punchline or the lead-in, so it isn't funny at all. I don't usually have that problem. They don't usually say I'm really funny. They say I'm wry, which means almost funny.
You're very wry.
Thank you. Thank you. I think.
However, for all these years, I thought that was a deli reference, but I could be corrected.
Nobody has said yet, you're quite pumpernickel.
Drawing from our own experience interviewing people, it startled me a bit to read this part where Mark Twain describes what someone being interviewed feels like.
All the time, at every new change of question, you are alert to detect what it is the interviewer is driving at now and circumvent him, especially if you catch him trying to trick you into saying humorous things. And in truth, that is what he is always trying to do. He shows it so plainly, works for it so openly and shamelessly, that his very first effort closes up that reservoir, and his next one caulks it tight. I do not suppose that a really humorous thing was ever said to an interviewer since the invention of his uncanny trade.
Once again, NPR's Hal Holbrook, Tom Cole as Mark Twain. Calvin, I blushed when I read that.
You don't think you're guilty of any of that, do you, Scott?
Probably all of it.
I would say, in the little interviewing I've done, in my defense, that I'm not trying to trick somebody. I'm trying to think of the next question, somehow avoid just dead air.
Are you looking forward to reading the Mark Twain autobiography, or?
I am. I'm a great fan of Mark Twain, and of course, when I hear there's a quote that sometimes attributed to Woody Allen, I don't know if he really said it, when he used to make these sort of Ingmar Bergman kind of movies, and people ask him why he did it, and he said that in America, humorists had to sit at the children's table. I thought, well, in the first place, in my family, people sort of fight to sit at the children's table. It's more fun. But also, Mark Twain would be there. And you'd think, wow, how did I get to sit at the same table with Mark Twain? Also, we're both from Missouri,
yeah.
So I sometimes like to say Twain and Trillin and that Missouri crowd.
Well, thank you. It's been wonderful to talk to the surviving member of that Missouri crowd. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Scott.
Calvin Trillin speaking with us from Nova Scotia today. Mark Twain was a prolific letter writer. He once wrote Bret Hart, "I take my pen in hand to inform you that I am well and hope these few lines will find you enjoying the same God's blessing."
We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz.
The members of Congress who voted for reform stood with the millions of Americans who lost their jobs, their homes, their businesses, and their savings as a result of this crisis.
Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner speaking this week on the new regulations that will dramatically expand the government's oversight of the financial industry, a legislative victory for President Obama, but not necessarily a political one. James Fallows of The Atlantic is here to offer some context, as he does most Saturdays. Hi, Jim.
Greetings, Guy. Nice to talk to you.
Jim, financial overhaul, arguably the second most significant piece of legislation that President Obama has pushed through Congress since assuming office. And yet it's fair to say he's not really reaping many benefits from it.
No, he isn't in the short term. And I think the long-term effect of the Obama presidency, whether it's one term or two, will be affected by these two big bills he's passed so far, the health reform and this financial reform and the climate bill that he's still working on. But in the short term, it still is the case that the most important variable for political success is the unemployment rate. And I think that in a way, the president's situation is very much like that of Ronald Reagan in 1982, when President Reagan was able to get through a number of his big tax cut and other measures. But the unemployment rate was really bad then, and so he suffered in the 82 midterm elections, his party did, and that seems at the moment to be the prospect for the Democrats.
And I noticed that President Obama's poll ratings are almost identical to Ronald Reagan's in 1982.
Yes, and I think the overall situation is very much like that of Ronald Reagan in 1982. I mean, you can't say, therefore, Barack Obama will be reelected, therefore the course will be just like the Reagan presidency. But I think the iron law of politics we see illustrated here is that absent 9/11-type attacks or other true national emergencies, the variable that matters most in a president's popularity and that of his party is the unemployment rate. And since unemployment is so serious a problem now and hasn't really been getting better for a while, that's the main political reality for the president and the Democrats.
Jim, obviously I've alluded to this already, but I wonder what you make of this idea that the more the Obama administration actually accomplishes, right, for better or worse, depending on your perspective, the more it creates this perception of either an overzealous government or simply a gridlocked, incompetent one. How do you sort of explain that?
Well, I think that many aspects of America seem more vital and self-renewing than its governing structure does right now. We've talked about the gridlock in the Congress and all the rest. I think that the challenge for this administration now is that the perception that the government is doing too much by the main president's main critics, he probably is not going to make that any worse by trying to get some of these reforms through, whether it's health or finance or climate bill or whatever, because that perception is already there. And so probably the best thing he has to work with is at least the offsetting sense of competence and effectiveness for his base. So I imagine that's the way they are trying to proceed.
Jim, earlier this week, Richard Holbrooke, who of course is the U.S. envoy to Pakistan and Afghanistan, testified in front of a Senate panel on Afghanistan. He was asked whether there was a Vietnam parallel, which must have struck a nerve with him, given that Holbrooke, of course, was a young diplomat in Vietnam.
This was a riveting moment of the testimony. Richard Holbrooke, of course, has had a very prominent career in American and world affairs since the early 60s when he was a young Foreign Service officer in Vietnam. And he said, senators, this is very different from the situation in Vietnam because this time in Afghanistan, our national security is at stake. Now, what, of course, was so striking about that is that back in the 1960s when similar hearings were being held, the argument about why the United States needed to stay and prevail in Vietnam was exactly that. That America's national security was at stake. So it was both a sign of how much history has changed and, to my mind, a sense of the changing politics and reality of Afghanistan, that essentially that was the crux of the argument. So many things seem to be going poorly in Afghanistan now. And his final argument was, it simply is too important to our national security. We can't leave.
Finally, Jim, I have to ask you about this strange case of the Iranian Shahram Amiri. He returned to Iran this week after claiming to have been abducted by the CIA. Now, for months, the CIA had denied all of these rumors of this guy's existence. Now that he's come out, the CIA is just singing, basically saying he volunteered all of this information. He was a valuable resource. Do you get the sense that this was bungled by U.S. intelligence?
You know, anything is possible, and it will take a long time, if ever, before we know what really went on here. I think the only definite news I have from this episode is that a wonderful novel published last year by David Ignatius of the Washington Post called The Increment, which was based on just this kind of scenario, a young Iranian defector from the nuclear program who may or may not be playing for one side or the other. That novel has new life. And as for the underlying reality, who knows?
That's James Fellows. He writes for The Atlantic. He's also with us regularly on this program. Jim, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Guy.